Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Samuel chapter 12. This is Samuel's farewell speech. We'll do all 25 verses today. Our context is this. Saul, in the last chapter, chapter 11, has just defeated the Ammonites at Jabesh Gilead and has made himself a hero, and the people have responded and inaugurated him as an official king at Gilgal. And so Samuel is now got Saul set up, and so he's getting ready to say bye-bye. So we start now in 1 Samuel 12, verses 1 and 2. Then Samuel said to all Israel, "Behold, I have listened to your voice and all that you said to me, and I have appointed a king over you. Now, here is the king walking before you, but I am old and gray. And behold, my sons are with you, and I have walked before you from my youth, even to this day." Now, where is this taking place? Where did Samuel say this to all Israel? That would be at Gilgal. That's the same place, probably, where Joshua crossed the Jordan River, right north of where the Jordan River runs into the Dead Sea, right across South Jericho, right east of Jerusalem, the famous Gilgal where Joshua set up the tabernacle and where Joshua operated from at the very beginning of the conquest. And so this is the same Gilgal where, in the last chapter, Saul had just been proclaimed king by the people as they're are feeling very jolly because of Saul's victory over the Ammonites, who were oppressing Israel severely, oppressing the Benjaminites in particular severely, and the people in Jabesh Gilead, that's in Manasseh, East Manasseh. So this is where they are, and Samuel gives his little speech. Now, what we'll see in this speech, it's really an interesting farewell speech because he chastises them mightily for their wanting a king. Now, usually when you give a goodbye speech, it's all, "We've had a great time together, and it's great that you've worked with us before, and you're now retiring, and let's give you a gold watch." No, not Samuel. He's going to let them hold it. He's going to say, "Yeah, I got you a king, all right, but you shouldn't have asked for one to start with." In verse 2, Samuel says, "Now here's the king walking before you." That's referring to Saul. I'm sure Samuel pointed Saul out. "But I am old and gray." And the meaning of this, the purpose of this statement is Samuel is saying, "Look, I'm old. It's time for me to pass the reins of power over to Saul." And then he says something that's a little bit opaque. "And behold, my sons are with you." Why would Samuel take the trouble to say that his sons are with the Israelites? Well, here's some options, especially since his sons are reprobate. I don't have the verse that says they're reprobate, but I remember it. I know that's true. Why would Samuel do this? Well, here's option number one, to show that his sons were private citizens and they had no pretensions of taking over the government. "So don't worry about my sons. Don't worry about the succession to the throne. It's Saul's, not mine." That's option one. Option number two, "My sons are with you," says Samuel, in order to show that if they had done anything criminal, they were subject to legal process. They're with you. They're subject to your courts. Option number three, "My sons are with you," says Samuel, to answer any questions that people might have had about my, Samuel's, conduct in office. Option number four, "Here, my sons, they are your hostages, should Samuel need to make any satisfaction or restitution for any crime that he had done while he was in office." And he's so sure that he hasn't done any crimes that he's not worried about having his sons being taken hostage. Option number five, he tells the Israelites, "Here are my sons," in order to show that Samuel had removed them from office. He had reduced them to the level of common people. And even though they were reprobate, if I remember, they were down in Beersheba and they were taking bribes, if I recall the story. And he's saying, "Well, here they are. So I'm clean. And now my sons are with you. So they're gone. So I have not left you in a bad situation." Now, Adam Clark generally says that option number five is correct, that Samuel had removed the sons from office, and so therefore the Israelites had no complaint. Notice he didn't pardon his sons. He turned them over to the justice of the Israelites. And so Saul is saying, "I'm clean, guys. I've done everything right. I've listened to you. I've given you a king. I've removed the stain of disgrace of my reprobate sons." And he says in verse 2, "I have walked before you from my youth, even to this day, and I've been..." His youth, remember, he was called, he was the son of Hannah up there at Ramathaim Zophim, and at Shiloh, about 20 miles east of there, where he grew up with under Eli. So, yes, from his youth, he heard the voice of God. He was a prophet, even from his youth, even to the time that he's old and gray. So Samuel's he's a good guy. We go down to 1 Samuel 12, verses 3 through 5. "Here I am," says Samuel, "bear witness against me before the Lord and his anointed." His anointed is Saul. Whose ox have I taken, or whose donkey have I taken, or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed, or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? I will restore it to you. They said, You have not defrauded us, or oppressed us, or taken anything from any man's hand. He said to them, The Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that's Saul, that you have found nothing in my hand. And they said, He is witness. That last he is either the Lord is witness, or Saul is witness, or is both the Lord and Saul. The reason I say both Lord and Saul, if you look at the Young's literal translation, it reads this way. A witness is Jehovah against you, and a witness is his anointed this day, that you have not found anything in my hand. And they say, a witness. That's close to the literal, and that sounds like it could be both God and Saul as a witness. It really doesn't matter. Let's just say it's Yahweh, because that's the greatest witness that you can appeal to. I haven't done anything wrong. That's a solemn oath. I've been honest. It's really interesting how Samuel's word about any accusation of corruption or skullduggery or bribe-taking, because that is the common sin of people in power, taking bribes. Now, that is a common problem of people in office, that they might take bribes. But let's look a little further into this. Why was Saul so intent on proving, or Samuel, not Saul, why was Samuel so intent on proving he was innocent of crime? Why was it even a question? It should have been obvious that Samuel was innocent. It could be to show that Samuel's motives were pure when he reproved the Israelites for wanting a king. In other words, if you are attacking somebody, as Samuel is going to be doing here in a minute, it would be very easy for the people to come turn back around and say, the reason you are attacking us, Samuel, is because you're corrupt. And so what Samuel is doing here, he's trying to prove that he's not trying to blow smoke around his own crimes. Jameson Fawcett Brown suggests that one of his motives could be is that Samuel had done nothing to make them want a king. They should have been content with the honest government they had. Samuel was honest, and he's going to talk later about all the deliverances that happened under the judgeship without a king. So we got honest government and military success, and now you want a king? What's the matter with you guys? Now in verse 3, Samuel refers to Saul as his anointed. Alfred Barnes says about this that, quote, this is the earliest instance of an actual king of Israel bearing the title of God's Christ, God's anointed one, and thus typifying the true Messiah or Christ of God. Well, I have trouble with that. Just because Saul was anointed, all kings were anointed. All of them are going to be messiahs. All of them are going to be types of the Messiah, Jesus. I don't think so. But Saul was anointed as king. We go now to 1 Samuel 12, verses 6 through 9. Then Samuel said to the people, The Lord, who appointed Moses and Aaron, and who brought your ancestors up from the land of Egypt, is a witness. Now present yourselves, so I may confront you before the Lord about all the righteous acts he has done for you and your ancestors. When Jacob went to Egypt, your ancestors cried out to the Lord, and he sent them Moses and Aaron, who led your ancestors out of Egypt and settled them in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God, so he handed them over to Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor, to the Philistines, and to the king of Moab. Those enemies fought against the Israelites. Now, Samuel is now going to recite all of the Lord's great works for the Israelites. Why did he do that? To point out the Israelites' ingratitude in rejecting God as their king. That's his main motivation. He says in verse 6, The Lord, Yahweh, who appointed Moses and Aaron, his point there was that whenever Israel got in trouble, God raised up deliverers. Israel was in trouble. Well, in Egypt, well, there's Moses and Aaron to get them out of trouble. So they didn't need a king. And then he mentions also in verse 9, when they forgot God, they ended up under the control of Sisera, who was the commander of the army of Jabin, who was king of Hazor. And Hazor is one of those Syrian kingdoms, Aramite kingdoms, right to the north of Israel. That was in the famous story of Deborah and Barak, who beat Sisera. And of course, the point there is, when you were enslaved by Jabin of Hazor, God gave you a deliverer, a judge, Deborah and Barak. So what do you need a king for? And then in verse 9, Samuel goes on to mention the Philistines. Well, who beat the Philistines? Remember Samson pulled down the temple on top of them in their temple with Dagon the fish god in there? You didn't need a king then when you had Samson. And then Samuel goes on to mention the king of Moab. Now, that's not quite as famous a story, so let me read that. This is in the times when Ehud was judging Israel, and Eglon was king of Moab. So the king of Moab is Eglon. We read that in Judges 3, verses 14 and 15. The sons of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. But when the sons of Israel cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, the son of Gera the Benjamite, a left-handed man. And the sons of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab. Ehud is left-handed and Eglon is big and fat. To help you remember that story. And so anyway, Samuel was mentioning all these famous deliverances, famous subjections that Israel had to their enemies. They didn't have a king, but they got delivered from every one of them. We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 12, verses 10 through 11. They, that's the Israelites, cried out to the Lord and said, "We have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. But now deliver us from the hands of our enemies and we will serve you." This is Samuel quoting out what, citing what the Israelites did in the past when they got in trouble. And his point was, hey, when you got in trouble, you didn't ask for a king. You just said, deliver us from the hands of your enemies. They asked the Lord directly to deliver them. So what do you need a king now for? Verse 11, then the Lord sent Jerubbaal and Bedan and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you from the hands of your enemies all around so that you lived in security. Now we need to break down some of these names. The Lord sent Jerubbaal. That's Gideon's other name. I think it means Baal destroyer because he pulled down his father's statue of Baal in the city square in his hometown there. And then the next deliverer is Bedan. Now that's questionable. The NIV has Barak. The NIV margin says some Septuagint manuscripts and the Syriac version have Barak. The Hebrew is Bedan. Well, John Gill says it ought to be Bedan. It ought to be Barak too by mentioning Hebrews 11:32, and we'll see this. For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, and Samuel. If you look at the progression of that list of deliverers there, we got Gideon first, which matches 1 Samuel 12:10. And then the second in the list in Hebrews 11 is Barak, where it's Bedan in 1 Samuel 12:10. And so that therefore people think that it should be translated as Bedan should be translated as Barak. Then we have Samson, which is not mentioned in 11:32, but then Jephthah is mentioned. Jephthah also in Hebrew. Jephthah is mentioned in 1 Samuel 12:10, and also Jephthah is mentioned in Hebrews 11:32. David is mentioned in 11:32, not mentioned in 1 Samuel 12. But then the next mention is Samuel in 1 Samuel 12:10, and Samuel in Hebrews 11:32. So the general order is the same, and Barak fits in that general order. Barnes says the form of the letters of both words, Bedan and Barak, being in Hebrew somewhat similar. Well, that's good enough for me. So we're going to say Barak. Jerubbaal delivered against the Midianites, Barak against the Aramites, the Syrians, Jabin of Hazor, Jephthah, he was the one that fought against the Ammonites, and then, of course, Samuel himself. He's mentioning himself here quite modestly. Samuel is the one who fought against the Philistines. He didn't have a reason to. He didn't need to be modest here. Samuel had delivered them from the Philistines. Remember the big battle at Mizpah. So Samuel says here in verse 11, look, all these deliverers delivered you from the hands of your enemies all around so that you lived in security. His implied statement is, so why do you need a king now? We go now to 1 Samuel 12, verses 12 through 15. When you saw that Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us, although the Lord your God was your king. Now therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen, whom you have asked for, and behold, the Lord has set a king over you. He's talking about Saul. If you will fear the Lord and serve him, and listen to his voice, and not rebel against the command of the Lord, then both you and also the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God. If you will not listen to the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the command of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you, as it was against your fathers. Now there's a question of how many times that the people asked Samuel for a king. Some say this was not the first time in verse 12 here that they had asked earlier, referring back to 1 Samuel 8:5, and they said to him, behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations. Well, I'm assuming that verse 12 here is referring to 1 Samuel 8:5. There was one time when they asked, two incidents, or it could be two reports of the same incidents. And I think that's probably what it is, two reports of the same incident. When they asked for a king is because old Nahash of Ammon is threatening to attack, and it scared the Israelites so bad that they asked for a king. instead of for a deliverer, a temporary deliverer. Ellicott says this, quote, "It has been suggested with great probability that Nahash and the Ammonites had invaded the Transjordanic territory of Israel," that would be at Jabesh-Gilead, "in the period immediately preceding the demand addressed to Samuel for a king, and that the invasion which culminated in the siege of Jabesh-Gilead was only one of a series of destructive forays and invasions." All right, so that's what we're going to say. Nahash frightened the people. They asked for a king. Samuel replies, "Hey, the Lord your God was your king. So what do you want another one for?" Now, the Israelites look pretty bad here for asking for a king. However, perhaps as in mitigation of their error, we should point out that Samuel was old. The Israelites might not have had as much confidence in Samuel as they had before. However, we might say that, but in God's and Samuel's eyes, this was no excuse. It's obvious as we go through this speech of his that he's reading them the riot act about asking for a king. So that's no excuse to say Samuel's too old. God was their king. He could have delivered them, but they didn't trust God. They didn't trust Yahweh. Now, Samuel softens up his chidings a little bit. He says, "However, if you will listen to the voice of the Lord, don't rebel against the command, and if your king, Saul, will follow the Lord," which he didn't, but if he would follow the Lord, "then as a result, both you and the king will follow the Lord your God if you don't rebel. But if you don't follow the Lord, and if you do rebel, the Lord will be against you." How? Famine, sword, pestilence, captivity, subjection to enemies, all of which the Israelites suffered through the history of their monarchy, which we're going to get to when we get to 1 and 2 Kings, or 2 Samuel 2. So, they were warned. We go down to 1 Samuel 12, verses 16 through 19. "Even now," Samuel continues, "take your stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call to the Lord, that he may send thunder and rain. Then you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord by asking for yourselves a king." So Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. Then all the people said to Samuel, "Pray for your servants to the Lord your God, so that we may not die, for we have added to all our sins this evil by asking for ourselves a king, the Lord your God." Not the Lord our God, but the Lord your God. They must have been feeling a little estranged from Yahweh at this point. Verse 16, Samuel says to the Israelites at Gilgal, "Take your stand." Then Avi says, "Stand still and see this great thing." Holman Christian Study Bible says, "Present yourselves." So this is a little formal occasion here. Why? Because there's going to be a great thing done, which is that there was going to be thunder and lightning. When you say, what's thunder and rain? What is so magnificent about thunder and rain? Well, it's because it's at the time of the wheat harvest. Verse 17, Samuel says, "Is it not the wheat harvest today?" And what he's saying is, you know, it never rains during the wheat harvest. Never. But it's going to right now, thunder and rain. "Then you will know." Know what? Know that your wickedness is great. So Samuel is not only going to read in the riot act verbally, he's going to give them a big sign to show that God is angry with you people for asking for a king. Reminds me of churches asking for a pastor. "Oh, we can't get along. We need a pastor. Give me a pastor, give me a king." I had a friend who did a little teaching on that one time. I thought that was great. The New Testament church folks didn't have one king. They had several elders, several rulers, several leaders, not one, plural. And more churches today, I notice, have been doing that. Even big churches are doing that, plural elders. Now, this thunder and rain came during the wheat harvest. Very unusual. Rain usually only came twice in Israel, in the spring and the fall. The spring being the former rain, the fall being the latter rain, when the crops were planted, but not at the time of the harvest. June and July would be when they would harvest. Middle of the summer, no rain, and there it was, right after Samuel prayed. So it's obvious it's a sign. Now you notice Samuel says, "Pray for your servants to the Lord your God." They didn't say to the Lord our God. The people said to the Lord your God, Samuel. I suppose that the people of Israel must have been feeling pretty estranged from Yahweh at this point. So he's the Lord your God, Samuel. "Pray, Samuel. Pray to Yahweh that we may not die." Well, the people's attitude got a lot more humble very quickly. They finally admitted it was sinful of them to ask for a king, something they have not admitted before in the past. So let me repeat, Samuel really let the Israelites hold it because of their sin. This was not the usual way one gives a farewell address, by having a big sign to point out that the people are sinful. We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 12, verses 20 through 25. Samuel said to the people, "Do not fear. You have committed all this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. You must not turn aside, for then you would go after futile things which cannot profit or deliver, because they are futile. For the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name, because the Lord has been pleased to make you a people for himself. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you. But I will instruct you in the good and right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king will be swept away. Now, when Samuel says to the people, do not fear, in verse 20, he could be referring to the thunder and rain that just came, and that might have frightened the people. Or it could be, he's saying, look, Israelites, don't fear that God is going to destroy you for your sin of wanting a king. It could be both, whatever it is. He says, calm down, don't fear. You have committed all this evil. He doesn't hold his words back. He doesn't mince his words. You're evil. You've committed evil. But that's in the past. Do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. That's in the future. Do right. Follow God. Don't turn aside. Don't go after futile things like idols, which cannot profit or deliver because they are futile. The Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name. In other words, you sin, but God is still going to be your God, and you will still be his people. Now, when Samuel says the Lord will not abandon his people, that's a general statement, but because it is true that the Lord will temporarily abandon his people when they sin. For example, at the Assyrian exile in 722 BC and the Babylonian exile in 586 BC, yeah, the Lord abandoned them to exile. God has constantly got the problem. I need to chastise my people, but as soon as I chastise them, then all the pagan people will say, see there, Yahweh's not much of a God. He can't even protect his people. So God always had to work around that little problem. But the Israelites could not rely on the fact that they were Israelites like they tended to do in the time of Jesus. Abraham is our father. Well, Abraham is your father, so what? Jesus said, you know, that doesn't matter. But people always say that because we're God's people. Jews would always say that because we're God's people. God's not going to let anything happen to us and we're blessed, so get out of my way. Well, the Assyrian and Babylonian captivity plus other judgments prove that that's not good thinking. God will abandon his people to punish them temporarily, but ultimately to fulfill his prophecy, there's going to be a nation of Israel all the way up until the new Israel, the church is established. So Samuel is right. The Lord will not abandon his people ultimately. He won't do that because of his great name. And of course, that is a common reason that God gives for not destroying the Israelites. In fact, he gives that reason for not destroying Israel because of his name, because of his reputation. He gives that reason even more than the reason that he shows mercy and love for the Israelites as the reason he didn't abandon them. Actually, he mostly says it's because of his great name. J. Palmer Robertson, the well-known Reformed theologian, mentions that. I don't have cites in front of me. I wish I did. But just from my memory as we've gone through the Old Testament, it happens all the time. What are people going to say, God? Moses, I recall, going to God. What are people going to say, God, if you wipe out the Israelites? It's going to look like the gods of Egypt are stronger than the God of Israel. Well, at any rate, God doesn't abandon his people on account of his great name, not because of the good works of the Israelites. The Israelites were not deserving at all of being preserved. Now, Samuel finishes up very graciously. He says, as for me, I'm not going to sin before Yahweh by ceasing to pray for you. I'm going to keep praying for you. So Samuel shows that not only has Yahweh forgiven the people, but so has he forgiven the people. Recall the people had just asked him to pray for them in 1 Samuel 12:19, a few verses previous. Then all the people said to Samuel, pray for your servants to the Lord your God so that we may not die. Pray for us. And then Samuel responds here, I'm not going to sin before the Lord by stopping to pray for you. Yes, I'm going to pray for you. And then he finishes verse 23 by saying, I will instruct you in the good and right way. So he's a prophet all the way to the end. The instruction is kind of a prophetic encouragement to do right. So he's praying and prophesying over the Israelites to the very end. And in verse 25, Samuel finishes his farewell address by saying this, but I'll pray for you. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king will be swept away. As Adam Clark says, never was a people more fully warned, and never did a people profit less by the warning, because their king was swept away, two of them as a matter of fact, with Assyria and Babylon. And yes, the Israelites did wickedly. Read the history of the kings, which we will do as we continue our podcast. Oh yes, they did all kinds of wickedness. So Samuel He prophetically, correctly prophesied here, but of course it didn't take a great prophet to know this. This is just common sense. You sin before Yahweh, you're going to get swept away. So with those words of warning, Samuel is now given his farewell address, and we are now prepared to look at our next chapter and our next audio for Samuel 13, the entire chapter, verses 1 through 23. We will see Saul fighting the Philistines. I hope you stay tuned for that chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.